but he soon threw himself into it, spinning and stomping and jumping. Soon he was moving with abandon, but deliberately, not frantically. I sat directly in front of him, held my head up, and watched. I watched him, as a clear-eyed witness of what he was doing, and of what he was, of all of it. There, at the end of the world, he danced in the broad and endless daylight, and I accepted him for what he was, instead of for what he wished he could be. The potency of my acceptance made me wonder, just a little, if I could turn it inward and accept myself. I didn't know, but I promised myself that I would figure it out on another day. Today was already taken. Today was for watching a great man dance in the snow. Chapter 5. All of the sex on planet Earth is biologically designed to serve one evolutionary purpose: to mix the genes of two separate individuals and then produce a new individual sporting genes identical to neither parent. Within this new mix of genes are unprecedented possibilities, old weaknesses eliminated, and new weaknesses that might even turn out to be strengths. This is the mechanism by which the wheels of evolution turn. All sex involves touch. The living tissues of two separate individuals must come into contact and then attach. Contacting and attaching to another individual is a big problem for plants. They are anchored in place, and their survival depends upon their immobility. Nevertheless, the vast majority of plants faithfully produce a new crop of flowers every single year, fulfilling their half of the reproductive bargain, even though the odds of these flowers eventually becoming fertilized are small. Most flowers are built simply, a platform of petals surrounding the male and female parts. On the outer ring of this circle is the male component, a few long stalks with wads of pollen glued loosely to the ends. In the center and at the bottom of a shoot sit the ovaries. Of all the things that could travel down this open shoot, a grain of pollen from the same plant species is the only thing that might activate fertilization. Self-fertilization is slightly more likely to occur, which means that the ovules will come in contact with pollen from the same flower. This can result in a seed, and then possibly a new individual, but no new genes will have been introduced. For the species to persist and evolve, real fertilization must happen periodically. And this means that pollen from 1 or 10 or 10,000 feet away must successfully arrive at the ovaries. There is a wasp that cannot reproduce outside the flower of a fig. This same fig flower cannot be fertilized without the help of a wasp. When the female wasp lays her eggs inside the fig flower, she also deposits the pollen that coated her when she hatched within a different fig flower. These two organisms, the wasp and the fig, have enjoyed this arrangement for almost 90 million years, evolving together through the extinction of the dinosaurs and across multiple ice ages. Theirs is like any epic love story, in that part of the appeal lies in its impossibility. Such specificity is extremely rare in the plant world, so rare as to be hardly worth mentioning, except as a feel-good example of symbiosis between ecological soulmates. Much more than 99.9% of pollen produced in the world goes absolutely nowhere and fertilizes nothing. As for the infinitesimal number of grains that arrive in the right place, it seems irrelevant to claim that it matters how they got there. Wind, insects, birds, rodents, or the empty corners of FedEx boxes. The vast majority of plants have absolutely no preference as to the method of pollen delivery. Magnolia, maple, dogwood, willow, cherry, and apple trees. They spread their pollen on every kind of fly or beetle, luring them near with sweet nectar, but providing only enough for a brief taste. The value of an insect as a pollinator lies in the distance that it may travel, and thus less time spent lounging about on a petal means more time traveling in the air. Many shrubs in North America and Europe bear flowers with petals set to spring once weighted by an insect, smacking the bee full of pollen and back on his way. In contrast, the elm, birch, oak, poplar, walnut, pine, and spruce, as well as the grasses, all release their pollen to the wind. It goes farther than it would by insect, but never as directly to another flower. Wind-borne pollen travels for miles and then rains down indiscriminately. Enough of it hits its target, however, to keep the world perpetually blanketed by the great conifer forests of Canada, the giant redwood groves of the Pacific Northwest, and the expansive spruce forests that stretch through Scandinavia and Siberia. One grain of pollen is all that is necessary to fertilize an ovum and then develop into a seed. One seed may grow into a tree. One tree can produce 100,000 flowers each year. Each flower can produce 100,000 grains of pollen. Successful plant sex may be rare, but when it does happen, it triggers a supernova of new possibilities. Chapter 6. When I was 32, I learned that life can change in one day. Within certain social circles of the married, a single woman over the age of 30 inspires compassion similar to that bestowed upon a big, friendly stray dog. Although the dog's unkempt appearance and tendency toward self-reliance betray its lack of an owner, the way it gravitates hungrily toward human contact suggests that it might once have known better days. You consider letting it eat on the porch after you confirm that it is not mangy, but then you decide not to, vaguely worried that it might start hanging around because it has nowhere else to go. In the right venue, at a casual outdoor picnic perhaps, a stray dog is a curiosity and even an asset. Its muddy clowning provides a rosy window into the carefree life of a simpler being. As everybody's pet and nobody's responsibility, it is at least friendly, if not wholesome, and is remarkably happy given its humble lot. If a single woman can be thought of as a dog at such events, then a 30-something single man is effectively characterized as the guy manning the hamburger grill. He's sure to be plagued by the dog from start to finish, whether he likes animals or not. I met Clint at a barbecue of that sort, and he couldn't have shooed me away even if he had tried, because he was easily the most beautiful man I had ever seen. A week later, I worked up the nerve to ask our hostess for his email address, and then I wrote and invited him to dinner. After he accepted, I phoned to tell him the location, which was the trendiest restaurant I could identify near DuPont Circle. I'd certainly never been there, but it seemed like a place where people went on fancy dates, and Washington, D.C. was much cooler than Baltimore, I did know that. After giving him directions, I further stipulated, "I'll only show up if you agree that I am paying for dinner." I had always paid my own way through life, and I wasn't about to give that up now. "Okay," he laughed good-naturedly. "But you have to let me pay the next time." I didn't promise anything, but I took his words as a good omen. At dinner, I couldn't eat a thing because I didn't want to be distracted from the fact that something wonderful was happening. We left the restaurant laughing over our waiter's disapproving stares during the course of our 3-hour meal. We went to a pub a few blocks away and talked for hours while our drinks went untouched. We argued over the essential difference between measuring something and modeling it. We discussed mosses and ferns. It turned out that we had attended Berkeley and studied the same subjects at the same time. I knew many of his friends and classmates, and he happened to know many of mine. We even determined that we had sat in the same room on more than one occasion, both listening to the same seminar. We marveled over how in the world we could have missed each other all these years. It seemed obvious that we should make up for it now. They closed the bar, and I still didn't want to go home. We decided to go to his house, and he asked me if I wanted to walk or take a taxi. He saw the look on my face, and then stepped into the street to wave for a taxi. Where I grew up, we only ever saw taxis in the movies. Taxis were for people so sophisticated that they left their houses wearing shoes they couldn't even walk in. Taxi drivers were exotic guides into the unknown who dispensed detached wisdom while delivering you faithfully to an important place that you couldn't have found on your own. I was stunned to find that the ultimate proof of love, for me, was nothing heroic, but an easy and superfluous gesture performed just to make me smile. The love that I had to give someone had been packed too tightly and too long in a small box, and so it all tumbled out when opened, and there was more where that came from. We love each other because we can't help it. We don't work at it, and we don't sacrifice for it. It is easy, and all the sweeter to me because it is so undeserved. I discover within a second context that when something just won't work, moving heaven and earth often won't make it work. And similarly, there are some things that you just can't screw up. I know that I could live without him. I have my own work, my own mission, and my own money. But I don't want to. I really don't want to. We make plans. He will share his strength with me, and I will share my imagination with him, and in each other we will find a dear use for our respectively obscene surpluses. We will fly off to Copenhagen for the weekend and live in the south of France each summer. We will get married in a language that we don't understand. I will have a horse, a brown mare named Sugar. We will go to avant-garde theater productions and discuss them afterwards with strangers in coffee houses. I will give birth to twins like my grandmother, but we'll keep the dog, duh. And we will always take taxis and live like in the movies. And some of these things we do. And some of them we don't, like the horse. And it is better than a movie. Because it doesn't end. And we are not acting. And I am not wearing any makeup. Within a couple of weeks, I had convinced Clint to quit his job in D.C. and move into my house in Baltimore, knowing that his incredible talent for mathematics could get him a job anywhere. Soon after moving, he re-entered academia and took a job at Johns Hopkins researching the deep Earth in the same building as my lab. He spent his days writing fantastically intricate computer models designed to predict million-year flow within unfathomably hot and pressurized pseudo-solid rock, thousands of miles below the depth where the lava of a volcano brews. I couldn't understand, still can't, how he was able to study the Earth in his mind only, how he could imagine and observe its workings through the Baroque equations that he writes so fluently. The corner of his mouth always inky from the ballpoint pen that he doesn't notice he's been chewing. I have to see my science for it to be real. I must hold it in my hands and manipulate it, I need to watch plants grow and make them die. I need the answers that can come only from control. He prefers to set the world in motion and then watch it flow. Tall and thin and dressed in khaki, he looks and acts just as a scientist is expected to. And so acceptance into the profession has always been relatively easy for him. Nevertheless, his sweet, solid, and loving nature was a treasure overlooked until I recognized it and then decided to never, ever let it go. Clinton and I met in early 2001, and during the summer that followed, we took a trip to Norway so that I could show him the places that I love most. Long, low hills of pink granite with purple wildflowers pushing out of the cracks. Sparkling fjords superintended by sober-faced puffins. White birch trees illuminated by salmon-colored sunsets that last all night long. The Oslo leg of our trip was transformed into an impromptu wedding party after we took a number, waited in a queue for 20 minutes, and got married in the Rådhus, City Hall. Upon returning home to Baltimore, we went straight to Bill to surprise him with the good news. Bill had never commented on the guys that I dated, probably because it was obvious that there wouldn't be very many dates to comment on. But he'd been acting strangely since Clint had come on the scene, avoiding us the same way that a reformed felon avoids driving by the Huskau. For his part, Clint was confident that Bill just needed time to get used to the situation. It was exactly the same as with me and his three little sisters, he kept insisting. About a month earlier, Bill had moved out of my attic after buying the rundown house located just a few doors down. He now owned a four-floor row home that must have been beautiful in its day, but that day was long past. When he moved in, Bill had dumped all of his belongings on the first floor, having carried them over from my house one by one over the course of several days. He kept a few key items, coffee pot, razor, screwdriver, in a corner next to the nest of laundry that he crawled into and back out of when it was time to sleep and wake up. Bill had grand renovation plans for the place, but during that summer it looked like a heroin den, complete in every detail except for the drugs. The day after we returned from Norway, we knocked hard on Bill's door and then also rang the doorbell. At length we heard someone shuffling around, and a bit later we heard the lock turn. The door opened and there stood Bill in a ripped t-shirt and some faded swimming trunks. His hair was mussed and he was rubbing his eyes. We'd obviously woken him up. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. "Hi," I greeted him, standing there with Clint's arm around me. Then I burst out, "Guess what? We got married." There was a long pause while Bill looked at us blankly. "Does this mean I have to buy you a present?" he asked. "No," answered Clint, while I simultaneously responded, "Yes?" We stood there for a while, Clint and I with giddy smiles on our faces. Finally, I said to Bill, "Get dressed. There's a Civil War reenactment downtown at Fort McHenry, and we're going." "I'd join you, except that it's probably the War of 1812. You're a dumbass, and I have about 1 million other things to do," Bill answered, looking uncomfortable. "Watch your mouth, you filthy hippie," I chastised him. "I won't have you dishonoring our fallen heroes that way," I added. "Now put some fucking pants on, start acting like an American, and get into the Toyota." Bill still looked at us, and I knew he was conflicted over whether to consent or withdraw. I looked up at my new husband, the strongest and kindest man I had ever met, firm in my belief that everyone who had ever earned my love had a natural claim to his as well. "Come on, Bill, you're with us now," Clint said while offering his car keys. "Why don't you drive?" he added. Bill took the keys, and we spent the day at Fort McHenry. bobbing for apples and dipping candles and forging a real horseshoe. We ate hot dogs and cotton candy and watched the three-legged race and petted animals at the petting zoo, and we all got in for a reduced rate because it was, after all, Family Day. Chapter 7 Agronomists and foresters have charted the growth of hundreds of plant species, starting in 1879 when a German scientist noticed that the increasing weight of a corn plant, when graft against the days of its development, resulted in a line with a curious lazy S shape. These scientists had weighed their potted plants daily, and for the entire first month they saw very little growth. Then, during the second month, the plants' weights shot up sharply. They doubled in size each week until they reached their maxima at 3 months of age. The scientists were then surprised to see the weights drop off again, and by the time they began to flower and produce seed, the plants weighed only about 80% of what they had been at their largest. This scientific result was enduring, and the many thousand corn plants that have been charted since then have all shown a similar lazy S curve. We don't know exactly how it works, but a corn plant knows what it is supposed to be, even though it meanders along the way. Other plants display very different growth curves. The curve describing the development of the leaves on wheat resembles your pulse. A brief throb of growth that settles back into decline. The curve for a sugar beet also shows increase followed by decline. However, the curve makes a long, low arc centered on the summer solstice. The curve for the nuisance grass Phragmites looks like a pyramid. Birth and growth symmetrically bracketed by decay and death. Such curves are invaluable in the farm field or in the forest, where harvesting food or wood is a distant goal. By approximating the position of growing plants along these standard growth curves, one can guess a good date for harvest, and by extension, pencil in the possible payday associated with it. The growth curves of trees are diffuse and sprawling compared with the curves for smaller plants, as they extend for hundreds of years instead of for just one season. Each tree species is subject to its own unique curve. Monterey pine grows twice as fast as Norway spruce, but both trees are harvested for papermaking when they are of similar girth. As a result, Norwegian paper companies are more likely to be solvent and generally own larger territories than their American counterparts. Within the forest, the variation in stature among trees of the same age is far larger than it is for other organisms, including animals. Within the United States, the tallest 10-year-old boy is about 20% taller than the shortest 10-year-old boy. This same differential holds for 5-year-old boys, as well as for 20-year-old men. The tallest is about 20% taller than the shortest. Within a pine forest, the thickest 10-year-old trunk is about 4 times thicker than the thinnest 10-year-old trunk. This same differential holds for 20-year-old trees, as well as for 50-year-old trees. The thickest trunk is about 4 times thicker than the thinnest. It turns out that there is no right or wrong way to grow into a 100-year-old tree. There are only ways that work and ways that do not. Becoming a tree is a long journey, and so even the most experienced botanist cannot look at a twig on a sapling and accurately describe what kind of branch it might develop into over the next 50 years. Plant growth curves can be useful for guessing, but it is important to remember that they don't show us the future, only the past. They are improvised lines, drawn through data that was collected for plants that are mostly dead by now. The datasets that define these curves are not static, and every time a new plant is measured, it can be added to the graph. Each new data point changes the overall pattern slightly, and thus alters the growth curve. There is no way to mathematically predict the shape of these curves, even with the massive computers that can lately be brought to bear. Nothing in these growth curves tells us what a tree should look like, only what trees have looked like. Every plant must find its own unique path to maturity. There are botany textbooks that contain pages and pages of growth curves, but it is always the lazy S-shaped ones that confuse my students the most. Why would a plant decrease in mass just when it is nearing its plateau of maximum productivity? I remind them that this shrinking has proved to be a signal of reproduction. As the green plants reach maturity, some of their nutrients are pulled back and repurposed toward flowers and seeds. Production of the new generation comes at a significant cost to the parent, and you can see it in a cornfield, even from a great distance. Chapter 8. Being pregnant is by far the hardest thing that I have ever done. I can't breathe, I can't sit down, and I can't stand up. I can't put down the tray table on the airplane. I can't sleep on my stomach, and I've only slept on my stomach for the last 34 years. I wonder what kind of God and what kind of heaven decided that a 110-pound woman could carry 35 pounds of baby. I'm compelled to march in endless circles around the neighborhood, escorted by Reba, because the baby is quiet only when I am moving. He kicks me not with, "Here I am, Mommy," playful bops, but in the writhing torture of a man struggling against a straitjacket. I walk and walk and walk some more, a solitary parody of some pagan fertility parade, and I think about how neither I nor the baby is enjoying this suffocating arrangement. A manic-depressive pregnant woman cannot take Depakote, or Tegretol, or Seroquel, or Lithium, or Risperdal, or any of the other things that she's been taking on a daily basis for years, in order to keep herself from hearing voices and banging her head against the wall. Once her pregnancy is confirmed, she must cease all medications quickly, another known trigger, and stand on the train tracks just waiting for the locomotive to hit. The statistics are pretty simple. A bipolar woman is 7 times as likely to experience a major episode while pregnant, compared with before or after. Leaving her to ride it out without medication for the first 2 trimesters is the cruel reality upon which doctors insist. Early in the pregnancy, I wake up and vomit violently until I collapse onto the bathroom floor and lie there for hours, retching and crying in exhaustion until finally, in desperation, I began to hit my head against the walls and the floor, trying to knock myself out. I regress to my child's habit of begging Jesus for help, or at least for the mercy of oblivion. Later, when I come to, I can feel a cool film of snot, blood, saliva, and tears between my face and the tile floor. But I cannot speak, and I do not know who I am. My steadfast husband, who has been frantically on the phone, comes in and picks me up and washes me off and calls the doctor again. They take me in and try all the things that they have tried on me before. But in a week I am right back to doing it again. This goes on until Clint and the dog are the only beings in the whole world whom I can recognize by name. I go to the hospital in earnest and stay for weeks at a time, strapped down when nothing else works, and they put me through countless rounds of electroconvulsive therapy, which make me forget most of 2002. I beg the doctors and nurses to tell me why this is happening to me. And they do not answer. All of us can do little except count the days until it will be safe for me to take the drugs that I need. 26 weeks is a magic date. It ushers in the third trimester, a period of advanced fetal development for which the Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of a whole series of antipsychotic drugs to address the health of the mother. As soon as it is medically advisable, I'm put on this and that and the other medication regimen, and then slowly my more florid symptoms begin to come under control. I begin to drag myself into work, often just to spend the day sleeping on the floor of my office. I try, but find myself too weak to teach, and so I put myself on medical leave. One morning during my 8th month, I trudge through the front door of the building and stop to rest in the front office while mentally preparing to drag this extra 30 pounds down to my laboratory in the basement. I don't handle any of the chemicals, of course, but it comforts me to sit next to the humming machines and examine the readouts as they are produced, and pretend that the instruments need my approval and encouragement in order to continue with each next task. In preparation for my difficult journey down in the elevator, I sit on one of the visitor's chairs next to the photocopier and lean back behind my huge abdomen. I announce, "I think I get it now. This is the new me. He is never coming out. 18 years from now, I will have a grown man living inside my body." And although I don't really mean it as a joke, the secretaries chuckle in sympathy. Walter, the head of the department, walks in, and I automatically stand up, like a soldier coming to attention in the presence of a senior officer. I'm close to being the first and only woman ever awarded tenure in this 100-year-old ivy-draped department at Hopkins, and I instinctively know that I should hide any physical weakness that accompanies my pregnant state. Unfortunately, I've stood up too quickly, and the blood rushes from my head and I feel faint. I automatically sit down and put my head between my legs, knowing that this will pass in a minute or so. This lightheadedness is familiar because I have always been plagued by low blood pressure and tend to be resistant toward eating, viewing it as an endlessly recurring chore. Walter looks around in puzzlement, and at me in the middle of it all, having assumed the posture of a beached and prostrate whale. He goes into his office and closes the door. Someone offers me a cup of water, but I refuse it. I limp to the elevator, burdened by a new nagging worry that I can't quite put my finger on. The next day, at about 6:30 in the evening, Clint comes into my office, which is located just down the hall from his own. His face is drawn in such a way that I wonder if he has come to tell me that someone has died. He leans on the doorframe and says gravely, "Listen, Walter came into my office today." He pauses, looking pained. "He told me that you can't come into the building anymore while you are on medical leave."
"What?"
I cry out, more terrified than angry.
"How can they do that? It's my lab. I built that place."
I know, sighs my husband. "They're assholes." But he says it gently, to soothe me too.
"I didn't know they could do this,"
I respond as the hurt starts to sink in.
"Why? Did he say why?"
I ask. And the many, many times in my life when I have pleaded this question, "Why?" to those in power comes back to me, as does the fact that I have never, ever been given an answer that's good enough for me. "Oh, some bullshit about liability and insurance," he answered, and then continued, "They're cavemen. We knew that." I begin ranting.
"What the fuck? Half these guys are drunk in their offices, and they're hitting on students, and I'm the liability?
Listen, here's the reality. They don't want to look at a pregnant woman, and you're the only one who has ever set foot in this building. They can't deal. It's simple, he says softly, and his anger is calmer than mine. Part of me is still flabbergasted.
He told you to tell me?
Why didn't he come and tell me himself?
He's afraid of you, is my guess.
They're all cowards. I shake my head and clench my teeth.
No, no, no!
I insist. Oh, we can't do anything about this. He says quietly, wretchedly. He's the boss. Clint is wearing the same soul-worried look that I once saw on a magnificent and ancient elephant that had lost its mate of 30 years. He knows how much it hurts me to be banned from my own lab, the place where I feel happy and safe, especially now, and from the only place that I truly regard as home. In frustration, I grab my empty coffee cup and hurl it to the floor with all my might. It bounces on the carpet and does not break, but instead rocks itself into a smug and leisurely sideways pose. In it I see yet more evidence of my powerlessness, even over things small and meaningless. And I sit down, put my head in my hands, and sob onto my desk.
I don't want this anymore.
I choke out while practically keening, and Clint stands and witnesses my pain, and the weight on his heart doubles and doubles again. After my crying has abated, we sit together in silence, and sufficient unto the day was the evil thereof. 2 years later, Clint would tell me that all his affection for Hopkins died on that day, and that he had never forgiven them for hurting me. We talked about it with the benefit of distance and hindsight, how it probably was just for liability reasons and nobody's fault. But then we stood together, joined hands, gathered all of our loved ones and a few of our belongings, and moved thousands of miles away. And yet again I built up my lab from zero, with Bill at the middle of it. But on the day that I throw my coffee cup, I cry because I can see only what I am losing and not what I will gain, which is hidden from me by my 2-inch-thick uterus. After I'm banned from the department, I am at loose ends during the day, so I schedule my prenatal visits for the morning. I show up and the nurses and techs weigh me and ultrasound me and deliver the astounding news that I am 1 week more pregnant than I was 1 week ago. Strangers ask me how many months along I am, and when I answer 11, they expect me to laugh with them. But I fail even in this small thing. I know that I am supposed to be happy and excited. I am supposed to be shopping and painting and talking lovingly to the baby inside me. I am supposed to celebrate the ripening fruit of love and luxuriate in the fullness of my womb. But I don't do any of this. Instead, I grieve long and hard for the part of my life that is over now that this baby has come. I should revel in expectation and daydream in circles about the mysterious identity of this person coming together inside me, but I don't, because I already know him. From the first, I sensed that he would be a boy, and I knew he would have blonde hair and blue eyes like his father. I understood that he would have my father's name and his own personality, that he would be as hardy as all Viking men and women are, and that he will justifiably hate me for being an unfit mother, that part of me having grown up under too much shade and wizened without flowering properly. I breathe in and out. I drink gallons of milk and eat buckets of spaghetti and sleep many hours each day. And I try to focus on the fact that I am at least sharing my rich blood with him. passively giving him what he needs for now. I try not to think about my troubled mind. I try not to wonder when will be the next time that I lose my mind. I sit in a waiting room with 15-year-old pregnant girls, each facing a wall of trouble much taller than mine, but I am numb to the gratitude that this should inspire. I'm so sad that I cannot cry and so empty that I cannot pray. The doctor calls me in, and I notice that she is not wearing earrings. Neither am I. I reflect incongruously on the relative rarity with which I meet a woman who is not wearing earrings. "Well, you're pretty big, but otherwise you're right where you should be," she announces, looking at my chart. "The baby's heartbeat is strong, and your blood sugar is normal." "This is almost over," she says, and looks at me hard. She hands me some pamphlets and asks, "Have you thought about contraception for after the birth? I suppose you know that you can get pregnant even if you are breastfeeding." My mind spins. This last stage of pregnancy has been positively surreal. Acquaintances ask me when I will have my second kid. Doctors prod me toward contraception. How bizarre to question a woman who can't even picture herself with one baby about the logistics, or not, of a second. I stammer confusedly. "I don't think I can breastfeed. I mean, I have to work, and if I need medication or something..." "It's okay," my doctor interrupts. "He will grow fine on formula. I'm not worried about that." Her forgiveness for the very first of my failures toward this baby is so automatic and freely given that it pierces me. I feel the old childish hope involuntarily stirred, that perhaps this woman cares and understands. After all, she has my chart. Maybe she noticed all the ECT and hospital stays and medications. Then I catch myself and listlessly wonder again for which of my sins I am being punished. I am sick to death of this wound that will not close, of how my babyish heart mistakes any simple kindness from a woman for a breadcrumb trail leading to the soft love of a mother or the fond approval of a grandmother. I am tired of carrying this dull orphan pain, for though it has lost its power to surprise, every season it still reaps its harvest of hurt. This woman is my doctor, she is not my mother, I tell myself firmly, and I am humiliated in my need, even to myself. More immediate is the fact that someone somewhere who makes the schedules has already decreed that we have exactly 12 minutes for each other. After we confirm my next appointment, I leave the doctor's office. On my way out, I go into the bathroom and I vomit and shake. And afterward, I don't recognize the person in the mirror. She looks so sad and tired and greasy that I feel sorry for her, even before I fully understand that she is me. After 5 o'clock, when everyone in the building has gone home for the day, I take Reba and sneak into the lab. I cannot do anything productive, but I instinctively resist the cruelty of my department chair's order by staging a sort of one-woman pregnant sit-in. When Bill walks in at 7:30, returning from his first meal of the day, to find me sitting in the dark, I hastily rub my face in order to hide the fact that I've been unable to stop crying. He turns on all the lights and systematically begins to update me on each of our projects, reciting a detailed status for each one, a long, comforting litany providing concrete evidence that everything is actually okay. He is exhausted from doing both of our jobs, but the rockier the ground, the harder he pulls the plow. He doesn't know exactly what's been wrong with me or why I've been so absent. Neither do my friends or family, such as I have. and no one asks. I suppose that my lineage has been hiding the crazy for so many generations, that my secrecy on these matters was genetically hardwired. Bill assures me that it's okay for me to just stay home.
Seriously, no one is going to come in here. You don't have to guard the place at night.
He looks around surreptitiously and adds,
not with all the knives and shit I have in here.
As he pretends to fumble nervously with one of the cabinets. This preposterous statement represents a new high water mark in Bill's desperate efforts to make me laugh, or at least to provoke a sign of the old me when our paths do cross. Although we are both at a loss as to how to kill the despondent zombie that has taken over his best friend's ballooning frame, he does keep trying.
Jesus, you look miserable, he says. Why don't you go slaughter a pig or something? Isn't that what makes your people happy?
Bill is exasperated. Well, I am hungry, I offer. With much effort, we walk, I waddle, to Bill's house, and then watch reruns of The Sopranos while I eat the box of donuts that we bought on the way. At 9 o'clock, when Clint comes to pick me up and drive me the 3 blocks home, he opens the back door and hands me in, and tears roll down my face as we pretend that our car is a taxi. It is a good omen when you observe an experiment closely, prepared for the data to be subtle, but what you see is clear, forceful, and obvious beyond misinterpretation. I have been warned repeatedly that water breaking could be ambiguous, but later that evening, while sitting on the couch, I spontaneously find myself immersed in about a gallon of fluid. As the tide rises, I set my jaw and remark to Clint that we should probably go to the hospital. As he helps me up, he notices that my hands are shaking. We are going to the best hospital in the world, he reminds me calmly, and his confidence proves contagious. I gather my weak determination, and we pack up and drive downtown. It is about 10:30 in the evening, and as we pass through the miles of Baltimore urban housing projects, I see people trudging home after their long day out, needing rest but not anticipating any. We enter the hospital, and I am immediately comforted by the bright lights and buzzing activity, and strangely enough, an old feeling of safety comes back from my hospital pharmacy days. Each one of these busy people has a mission, and taking care of me is just a routine part of their huge, choreographed, collective task. Whatever happens, I will not be alone, and somebody else will be the strong, prepared, alert, and responsible one. A plan is coming together. Everybody will stay up all night, and we will figure this thing out. I start to relax. We share the elevator up to the maternity ward with an older patient who is being wheeled elsewhere by a young and bored orderly. She looks at my mammoth abdomen.
You ready for this?
She asks, and then shakes her head in wry amusement when I stare back at her dumbly, unable to formulate an answer. When we get to the registration desk, a huge woman swoops in after eyeing me and says to the receptionist,
I want her. She's got good veins.
And thus designates herself as my nurse. I look at the backs of my hands that are like my father's, and upon which the blood vessels have always stood out clearly, and I decide that this is also a good omen. The nurse leads us to a private room and ushers Clint toward a chair in the corner. He is to sit near the foot of the bed and keep himself out of the way. He complies.
This is not about you,
she explains to him over her shoulder as she guides me into the bathroom. With great effort, I use the toilet and then change into a hospital gown. The nurse helps me up onto the bed and swabs both of my wrists with alcohol. She then pulls out 10 or 20 needles, electrodes, clamps, and bands, and begins to attach them to me in myriad ways and places. After she finishes, she plugs each one separately into the machines and monitors that have begun to crowd around my bed as if they are eager to be included in whatever is going on. Once everything is turned on, I am surrounded by their friendly electronic faces on all sides, and each continuously repeats to me its own soothing story, as if they all understand that there is no upper limit to the amount of reassurance that I will require during my ordeal. The physician's assistant walks in. "Will you consider medication to help manage your discomfort during the birth?" he asks. "Yes. Yes, I will," I answer, using his same dry tone that belies the fact that I have never been more passionately sincere in my whole life. "Good for you," mumbles my nurse under her breath. "Ain't no reason for you to be in all that pain." When I hear this, I realize that I have just made her shift a whole lot easier. Every couple of hours, a different doctor, who is also a professor, herds a gaggle of medical students through my room and introduces me as a case study. He summarizes the results of all of my prenatal visits and lists the medications that I have taken in a terse and disjointed monotone, making the whole thing sound like an E.E. Cummings poem that didn't quite make his editor's cut. Then he asks his cohort, "So, what do we surmise about the fetus in this situation?" And the group responds with the same dumb silence one would get upon querying a flock of sheep. Finally, my nurse breaks in, saying, "Well, look at her. That baby ain't premature, and it ain't underweight neither." As she shakes her head in disgust, I see one of the students standing in the back yawn massively while looking right at me, and without even bothering to hide it. I suddenly become incensed, and it probably shows up on the electrocardiogram to my left. Instantly thrown back 15 years, I am again a college girl who desperately wants to go to medical school but knows from the start that she doesn't have the money and has no way to get it. I came from a line of women who could catch and pluck an owl, boil it up for the kids, and crack the marrow out for the baby, then drink the boil water because that was all that was left. I was the girl who could pull leeches off of herself, and who wasn't afraid of spiders, snakes, dirt, or the dark. I am suddenly again the girl who, having secured a scholarship that also paid for books, immediately went to the bookstore and bought all the medical texts, in addition to the course books that she actually needed. There these medical students are, on the other side of a heavy iron door that had been locked against me, and instead of glorying within the inner sanctum, they seem to be throwing it all away. I then proceed to wonder indignantly why these little bastards think they are even fit to measure my cervix. My rage awakens a bit of the old me, and in my head I edit the version of these events that I will relate to Bill, and here insert myself yelling,
"Write it down, motherfuckers! I'm gonna be on the test!"
The professor interrupts my internal tirade by announcing, "She has a severe risk for postpartum psychosis and will be observed accordingly." And just like that, he has given voice to something we all suspected, but that love and hope had both conspired to keep silent. I perk up, damned interested in what he might say next. Upon receipt of this novel tidbit of information, the students visually scrutinize me anew and appear so nonplussed with my sane presentation that I consider feigning a hallucination in order to validate the professor's point. While looking around the room in consternation, I lock eyes with Clint, who is sitting meekly in his corner chair with his legs crossed. Using the telepathic bond peculiar to married couples, We communicate our mutual recognition of the moment's absurdity, and I burst out laughing for the first time in weeks. It then occurs to me that I am feeling the best that I have in months, now that I am perched securely in my wiry little nest of beeping machines. Immune to both mirth and sorrow, the doctor consults his watch and walks out, with the students trailing behind like the world's lamest paparazzi following the world's most uninteresting celebrity. My anger relents when I suppose that they also have a long night ahead of them. My cooler head then leads me to consider the possibility that dreaming of being a doctor and the reality of navigating medical school are maybe not the same thing. And I also admit that my own demeanor during the past several months hasn't put me in a good position to condemn flat affect when displayed by others. A surgical nurse enters with what looks like a rolled-up beach towel and proceeds to unroll it across the length of two stainless steel trays. As he does this, I see that the inside of the sterile cloth is lined with dozens of scalpels, scissors, and various small glinting bladed objects. The assistant leaves and then returns with another towel, identical to the first, and repeats his actions onto two additional trays. "Oh boy," I observe. "That's a lot of knives." The nurse looks at me and continues with his task, explaining, "Yeah, this doctor likes to have a second set ready, in case something drops." I am not as comforted as I should be by this assurance that duplicates will be at the ready once the blades start to fly around, but I keep my misgivings to myself as he walks out. I am gratefully surprised to see my breastfeeding neutral doctor walk in and announce that she will be attending the birth. I had been told repeatedly to expect any of the doctors who populated my caregiving team, and was prepared for a virtual stranger, unable to recall even half of the medical characters who had traipsed across the stage of my life during the past 9 months. "I am glad that it's going to be you," I tell her with the trust and affection of a child. She looks over my chart. "How are you doing?" "I'm scared," I say, because it is true. I have always been convinced that I will die during childbirth. This is not only because I could never imagine myself as a mother. It is also fueled by my suspicion that this is how my maternal grandmother died. My mother never says much about her own mother, nor her brothers and sisters, except that the ones who survived childhood numbered more than 10. Discutere fortiden gir ingenting. You can't change the past by talking about it. The doctor stops and looks at me. "If something happens to you," she assures me, "we can have you prepped and in the operating room in 45 seconds. And I am momentarily enthralled by the idea that there must be another room around the corner with even more numerous and far more sophisticated instruments in it than this one. She then turns to Clint. "That being said, if something happens to you, like you faint, we will kick you to the side and keep going." Clint's mother was a prominent obstetrician in Philadelphia, and complicated births were the dinner table conversation of his childhood, so there is no danger of him fainting. But he nods his acceptance of the scenario described. She examines my cervix and concludes, "Everything looks good." She adds, "I'll be back after the epidural unless you need me," and then walks out. A couple of hours go by, during which the blood pressure cuff squeezes my arm encouragingly every 20 minutes, and reminds me in happy beeps that I am doing just fine. Then the contractions get really bad, and I begin to groan slightly with each one. "Lord, you sure don't say much," observes my nurse while changing the IV bag. Taking this as a compliment, I admit, "Well, it wouldn't help to carry on." "No, it sure don't," she agrees while opening the line that connects the IV to the veins in my arm. The contractions get much worse, and I begin to plead with Clint, quietly begging him to help me in wild-eyed whispers. He stares at me with the calm, friendly face of a Saint Bernard who has just dug you out of the snow, and who assures you that a rescue team will be here any minute, and would you like to suck on some ice chips while you wait?